Okay, don't start singing yet. Don't start singing. That's the guitar work of Steve Sato, who's been in here, I think, like the last 8 weeks in a row. But he's here for a purpose tonight, and he's here with two very special guests. In addition to his lovely wife, Amy, he is here with Jeffrey S. King, author of many books, including The Rise and Fall of the Dillinger Gang, and my new friend, Ellen Paulson, with her husband, Steve, both native New Yorkers. She, the author of a fascinating book, a number of fascinating books. The one I have halfway into is Don't Call Us the Miles, Women of the John Dillinger Gang. Thank you all for coming in here. And, okay, you can stop playing. Talk now. Talk now. Tomorrow's a big day. Tomorrow's the biggest day in your life, isn't it?
Well, I
wouldn't say that, but...
Except when you got married to Amy. It's the biggest day of your life. What's tomorrow?
Tomorrow is the anniversary of when John Dillinger was killed at the alley after he walked out of seeing a movie at the Biograph Theater. And, well, for many years, long before I hosted it or even...
was born.
Well, yeah. Yeah, no, went to this thing. This thing's been going on for probably almost, like... probably almost 40 years,
yeah.
Started by the author William J. Helmer, Bill Helmer.
Bill Helmer, who's been on this show, and who's a famous, famous Chicagoan, though he doesn't live here anymore. What I always talk to you about, Steve, whenever you're on, and I'm so glad you brought Jeffrey King and Ellen Paulson in here, is please explain to me, you two fine authors, the durability of the John Dillinger, not just the legend, but the person. You've both written books about him. What's the key to that durability, do you think? Jeffrey?
Yeah. Well, it's very strange because Dillinger wasn't really that violent. He did kill one man. But of course, other of the major public enemies at the time killed many more, you know. And... what happened was he himself, you know, didn't kill many, but anybody had any relations with him, it was very dangerous because often they ended up killed, you know.
But he also had this kind of Robin Hood thing about him that I have never been able to determine whether that was real or not.
Yeah.
You almost it was almost as if, and Ellen addressed this, and I do want to talk to you about the Dillinger women because that's a fascinating aspect of it. But you would almost think that Dillinger would rob a bank, and then he would come out and give the money to people in the street. Yeah. And fake or not? Well, fake news or not?
Fake news. Oh, another great Chicago resident, Tom Smussen, a renowned Dillinger researcher, once said to me, there were hundreds of guys like Dillinger, but he was in the place and time, and he was swept up by the media. And he was turned into an anti-hero, and because it was the depths of the Depression, for 3 cents a newspaper, people could read about someone who was experiencing the thrills of the fast life. That was cut off to many people during the Depression, and so
do you also, and Steve, get in on this too. Right. The way in which he was killed. You know, seeing Manhattan Melodrama, the girl in red, it is obviously been romanticized to death, but there are romantic elements to that whole thing, aren't there, Jeffrey?
Yes, well, absolutely. Well, he definitely was a media person. He had a terrific sense of humor. And, you know, when at Crown Point, they love the newspaper men get together, you know, he was arrested and went to Crown Point, Indiana.
Sure.
And, He looked like it was going to be inevitable. He was going to be executed, but he was smiling and making jokes, and he was the most self-confident person there, and they spoke for, you know, hours, and he told jokes, and he had charisma.
Well, and he beguiled the newspaper, the idiot. I'm a reporter, but he beguiled the naive idiot reporters for the various newspapers. Ellen, I know how you, Steve Sato, first got interested in all this. And remind me if I'm wrong. You were taken to the dentist.
No,
the,
Optometrist.
Oh, sorry.
My dad.
Someone was messing with your head right. nearby right. the office, and outside you could sort of see the
my
alley.
Dad, I went with my dad to the eye doctor, to the optometrist, and the office was next door to the Biograph Theater. And so when I was a little kid in the early 70s, when we came out of the thing or before we went in, whatever, my dad said, you know, John Dillinger was killed at that alley when he came out of this movie theater. And from that day on to this day, anytime I'm in that neighborhood, drive down Lincoln Avenue, I always have to look at the Biograph Theater and the alley. And it, like a little kid, and I'm still like that, you know. And
well, but you're more and more into it. I mean, you've helped as Bill sort of pulled out of the whole
Helmer.
Event,
yeah,
Helmer. The John Dillinger Died for You event, which is tomorrow at the Lincoln Station, which is directly across Lincoln Avenue from the Biograph Theater, yes. Now Victory Gardens Theater, yes. In the alley where Dillinger was killed. You always have special guests. These two, Jeffrey King and Ellen Poulsen, are the two most special guests I can remember you having.
Yeah.
How did you twist their arms to come in here?
Well, however many years ago it was now, I contacted Ellen. I just looked up her website or found her contact information.
Dillingerswomen.com
right.
is a great website.
Yeah. That's where I found it. I emailed her, introduced myself. She responded and said, my husband and I would like to come. And we already booked a hotel. And I was just thrilled.
You were overwhelmed.
Yeah.
And they are both, I must tell you, Jeffrey is not, but both of them, Ellen and Steve, are wearing Dillinger-related T-shirts.
Yeah.
Ellen, when he called you, when Steve called you, are there other Dillinger societies around the country, or is this like, were you intrigued? Steve's a nice guy, and he must have been very nice on the phone, but what drew you?
Well, I emailed her first. Yeah.
Okay, but what drew you to say, yeah, this sounds like fun?
You know, from time to time, I've attended with my husband other so-called Dillinger festivals. Tucson, Arizona has one. There's currently one happening in Dayton. There's one being planned for Lake County in the fall. They sanitize it a bit by calling it a celebration of law enforcement.
Yeah, that's sanitizing it a bit. This is put on by the John Dillinger Died for Your Sins.
John Dillinger Died for You Society.
Oh, right.
Which Bill Helmer created because a professor of his said, you know, you guys should like form some kind of John Dillinger Society.
So this sounded so much more enjoyable and to the point to you, right, Ellen?
And also, it's the source. I mean, the Biograph is the baptismal font of Dillinger lore.
What is Tucson? You say there's
Tucson.
What is Tucson?
Tucson, Arizona, was the scene of the biggest arrest of the gang. The nucleus of the Dillinger gang, the guys with whom he served time in prison, and they were kind of the blood brother gang, when they were all arrested at the same time. It was quite sensational for 1934.
Okay. I was thinking in Tucson, which must have really been a conflict.
Sorry, I should have...
Don't be silly.
Dillinger geeks tend to think that everybody knows these... these little nuances.
Well, you know what? Dillinger geeks do know all these little nuances. We've got to take a little break. We're talking to Ellen Poulsen, Jeffrey King, authors of a number of books related to John Dillinger. Steve Sato, who is the man in charge of the event tomorrow, John Dillinger Died for You. It's the 85th anniversary gathering of to commemorate the death of John Dillinger in the alley across from Lincoln Station, which is where this event will take place. We'll get into the event more and into the allure of John Dillinger, and also because you two are experts, and I'm not going to let any experts walk out of here without telling me, there, except for Dillinger geeks, I think most people do not know who the women associated with Dillinger were. Lady in Red, period. And the guys, I don't know who the gang members are. They have not been romanticized to the point of John Dillinger. So stay tuned. We'll be back in a couple minutes. That's Steve Sato playing the guitar. You will hear an entire song devoted to John Dillinger after the news at 9:30. Steve is here along with two incredibly talented authors, Jeffrey S. King and Ellen Polson. Ellen's also here with her husband, Andrew. They travel as a team. He's kind of like a bodyguard, I guess. And they will both be tomorrow talking and sharing their insights at the Lincoln Station, which is a very nice saloon tavern right across the street from the Biograph, where John Dillinger was slain in the alley next to the Biograph. The event starts at, what do you think, Steve, like 8 o'clock?
We kind of mosey on over there after having like a cocktail hour at the Red Lion. And so about people start gathering around 7:30-ish, and it's
free, too, ladies
free.
And gentlemen.
Things will get sure started around 8.
You two authors, you're going to have books available there, aren't
yes,
you?
Yes, we will.
Okay, thank God, because it's hard enough to sell books in the year 2019. Now, your book, Jeffrey, is titled The Rise and Fall of the Dillinger Gang.
Yes.
You know, the star-making apparatus in this country is such that newspapers generally used to help make stars. I frankly, who know a bit about Dillinger, I don't know much about the gang. How big was the gang? Who was in the gang? How did he form the gang?
There were really two gangs, the first and second gang. The first one, it was formed. First, Dillinger got out of prison, and he associated with some minor gangs. There was quite a few. But then Dillinger, when he got out of prison, he raised money, and this the first gang escaped from the Indiana prison, and it was a sensational escape.
Yeah.
They were about nine or ten people escaped, you know, and most of them formed the so-called first Dillinger gang.
Those and they were the Michigan City Penitentiary.
Yeah. And they were, you detail that in The Rise and Fall of the Dillinger Gang.
Yes.
Ellen, what has fascinated you and what you've focused on are the women that were part of this whole thing. And indeed, you know, the lady in red, that's all most people know about Dillinger. That's because the women who were involved with John Dillinger were kind of seen by the press as nothing but a bunch of prostitutes, basically.
Yeah.
That's very true. They were demonized from the top by the publicity machine of J. Edgar Hoover, and demonized all the way, almost until 1940, right before the dawn of the Second World War, because he wrote a series of books, 10,000 Public Enemies, books like that, hardcover, published by big publishing companies,
sure, because he
where he actually continued to write chapters about them, almost as though there was some sort of an obsession. And, you know, meanwhile, they
were
serving time.
Well, given J. Edgar Hoover, it could have been a weird
obsession.
It
could have been a weird obsession.
Character.
And they were, we can say
they
that
they dressed
now.
Better than Hoover dressed in women's
but,
clothes.
That's what some people have said. Yeah. But they had served prison sentences. Most had been sentenced to between 2 and 5 years in prison for harboring an outlaw, for harboring a federal fugitive, and brought in on indictments charging them with harboring. So they had paid their debts to society. And many, like Polly Hamilton, who was the other woman at the Biograph,
right.
the woman who wasn't wearing red that night, I guess, she continued to live in Chicago and changed her name, got married, changed her name, lived in, I believe it was Old Town, and was unrecognized for decades.
That's interesting, because I grew up in Old Town, so obviously I didn't recognize
you. Better look in your old photo album and see if you...
Yeah, maybe she might have been one of my teachers at LaSalle School.
She might have been your first crush.
Yeah, she could have been my first crush. I will look up those old photographs of little Rick Kogan. She would have been a little older, but I had no problem with older women even then when I was 5 or 6 years old. But you really do. It was important to you to give these women a due, to take that... It sort of taint off them, that Hoover stain that he had put on them. Why?
The books that I had read, I went through all of the books that were published during the, I guess, the 1980s. Great books. I love them. They're part of my canon.
Sure.
And they have proud places on my bookshelves. But my frustration with those books was that the women weren't mentioned much.
Yeah.
One or two sentences to write off women like Pat Sherrington and Opal Long, who were integral members of the gang. They weren't just girlfriends. They ran the inner workings.
Well, in a sense, I mean, you're elevating them, not quite, again, we're talking about the Star Machine, but you're elevating to the important level of, you know, Ma Barker or Bonnie Parker, at that level, that these women were hoodlums.
Well, people like Bonnie Parker and Ma Barker are household names.
No question.
Today. But names like Opal Long and Mary Kinder and even Helen Gillis, the wife of Babyface Nelson, nobody's ever heard of them. And maybe they should not be famous. They were notorious.
Well, they don't need to be deified or even admired, but they should be better known.
Well, if it wasn't for the work that they did, the gangs couldn't have functioned on the level that they did. They rented the apartments. They opened up safe deposit boxes to hide loot stolen from banks.
Well, and they must have also sort of scoped out the banks. It'd be a lot easier for a woman to go in and look around than some guy with a, you know, violin case or something.
It's a possibility, but mostly they sat in the back seats of the cars on top of the guns. And one time they stopped by a cop, and Mary Kinder was sitting on a bunch of guns, and she said something like, hey, my foot's killing me, we got to get out of here, something ridiculous. But you know, they were able to,
they were integral parts, as you said.
They moved the gang forward from one bank job to another, no doubt. It's, and from one city to another.
It's fascinating. We'll continue on with these fine and knowledgeable people. You, of course, can see them and talk to them tomorrow night at 2432 North Lincoln Avenue at the meeting of the John Dillinger Died for You Society in celebration of the day Dillinger died, 85 years ago. We got to get some commercials, then we'll get some news, and then we will carry on, and Steve will play and sing. He's the after-hours version of Bob Dylan. Ladies and gentlemen, Steve Sato.
All right. Well, let me. I'm going to perform this song.
I promise people. Of course,
yeah,
you're going to perform.
I want to explain what this is.
Okay.
So, with the John Dillinger Died for You Society that, you know, was created by Bill Helmer, as we call him. He had these membership cards and these membership kits, and part of the kit included the John Dillinger Died for You Society official songbook. And he wrote a number of songs, you know, Babyface Nelson, Pretty Boy Floyd, and
this is one of them.
And as far as I know, there's no actual recording of this. So me doing this live in the studio, if
it's
I
a world premiere,
get through it.
Okay,
yeah,
go.
The Ballad of John Dillinger.
In an Indiana farmhouse, John Dillinger was born. His family, friends, and neighbors this fine young man did praise, till with a hoodlum friend he held up a grocery store. They sentenced him to prison in 1924. In 1933, he gained his freedom once again, but 9 long years behind iron bars taught him a life of sin. He joined a bandit gang, all for one and one for all. They left the bank vault empty each time they paid a call. From bank to bank he made his way with a deadly Tommy gun, until the G-men voted him public enemy number one. They captured him in Tucson one January night, and found an Indiana cell they thought could hold him tight. The escape-proof jail at Crown Point was the safest in the land. Its 6 iron doors and 50 guards could hold most any man. But with his wooden pistol, Johnny found it not too hard to drive past the machine guns of a sleeping National Guard.
they had him cornered in Wisconsin where he hid. A trap so tight the Dillinger could not slip through its lid. Undaunted by the circumstance, he leapt into the free. And with his trusty chopper, he was master of the day. It was in the Great Depression, and the people cheered him on. For robbing fat cat bankers was not considered wrong. J. Edgar Hoover's FBI put roadblocks up in vain, but was forced to play the fool's part in John's superior game. He never harmed a lady, only cops and millionaires. He never double-crossed a friend, each deal he made was square. But the federals paid a woman who he trusted dressed in red. On the 22nd of July, John Dillinger lay dead. Crime is never his last, and means a life of hell. If his closest friends betray him, he must either run or fight. He knows no peace until the day a bullet ends his life. When his closest friends betrayed him, he had to run or fight. He knew no peace until that day a bullet.
Premiere, ladies and gentlemen. We're a radio premiere. Steve, that sounded great. Tomorrow night, you will be able to meet Ellen Paulson and her wife, Andrew, I suppose, your husband. You're going to be there, right?
Yeah.
You're the official bodyguard. Both of you, you and Jeffrey King, you have not written a book together yet about John Dillinger, but your books combined would make a fabulous, fabulous bookshelf. Have fun at the party. That's all I can say to both of you, and thank you for coming in. Jeffrey, you wanted to mention that Babyface Nelson, a Chicago character, was part of the second John Dillinger gang, correct?
Yes, and he's one of the three major ones from the so-called war on crime, the Great Depression, and Dillinger and he didn't really like each other, but he had to go with him because he helped him get out of jail.
Well, that's a good reason. That'll make a close friendship. Yes,
and he owed a lot of money to Nelson.
Well,
I had to pay. Rob Banks to pay off Nelson. And
speaking of that, the infamous wooden gun escape from Crown Point Jail.
Sure.
The American Society of Magicians awarded John Dillinger their annual Harry Houdini Award for the Crown Point escape.
Well, of course they did, and I'm sure 800 newspaper reporters wrote about it. Ellen, it's a pleasure to meet you. Andrew, you too, and Jeffrey, you too. You can meet them and buy their books tomorrow, starting at 6:30 at the Red Lion Pub, then moving down Lincoln Avenue South for an 8 o'clock sort of formal ceremony at Lincoln Station. Steve, Amy, all of you, have fun and do John Dillinger proud.
And hope to see you out there if you can pop over.
You never know about me. You never know. Me and Lincoln Avenue, I did.
I know.
Yeah. I've been thrown out at a lot of bars. Not recently, but in my youth, when I was dating the Dillinger girls. We'll be back in a few minutes to talk about the Eastland.
Oh.
Another cut from these new CD releases by Steve Goodman. Steve's been dead for a long time, but these bring him back and was kind of sad, and you miss him. There are not a lot of people around, except for the descendants of the 844 people who died the day the Eastland went down in the Chicago River. But they are honored, I think, in a fashion by one of the most compelling and indeed, I think, electrifying documentaries I've ever seen. Eastland, Chicago's deadliest day. If you're one of the 400,000 human beings that still get a print edition of the Sunday Tribune, you'll find a story in there. It's also online. It's a real treat to have the two producers of that in studio. Harvey Moshman and I go way back, and Chuck Coppola and I go back just as an admirer. Gentlemen, that is one hell of a movie.
Thank you very much.
I thought you were going to say, we know that.
No, we appreciate it. Thank you.
You two have been hooked on this story, the story of this ill-fated ship that went down with, for a long time. I mean, this is actually the second documentary you've made.
We made the first one in 2001 for TTW, and this is longer and has a better budget.
And richer,
very rich.
Well, it's one of those few things usually is sometimes when someone gets a larger check to play with, it doesn't always amount to this kind of creative form. What first hooked you guys on this story? Because it is, as I said in the piece, and it won't be after Thursday when the show is on at WTTW Channel 11 at 8 o'clock, be sort of one of the lesser known tragedies of Chicago. We tend to sort of, in some cases, glorify our tragedies. Wow, let's have a Chicago Fire Festival. Let's name a soccer team the Chicago Fire. Let's,
you have two stars of the Chicago flag. One is the Fort Dearborn Massacre. Yeah. The other is the Great Chicago Fire. I would say that Eastland deserves a spot on the flag.
I would, too. But what initially, you can be hooked by a piece of history, but when you first collaborated on that first documentary, what was it that sparked you?
This was a double tragedy. It was a horrific accident or event that happened in Chicago when the ship rolled over fully loaded. Then there was a second tragedy, and that is the legal travesty that happened, how the immigrant factory workers who were and their families were largely the passengers on this vessel. They had very little money. They had just come to America. They had little or no
clout.
Legal connections.
And certainly no clout.
No. And they absolutely got trampled in the courts. And so that drew me to the story.
The injustice.
The injustice of it, really. And also trying to find similarities and relevance to today. I think there are some similarities.
Well, I think there were in the original documentary. There are even more now. I mean, this film will have, I think, a serious, if people don't just watch it and go, oh my God, that's an amazing movie, and move on to whatever is next in their lives, that the whole notion of the immigrant population of this country, you do a wonderful job. One of the wonderful jobs you do is setting them in the Chicago of that time. What was the Chicago of their time, Harvey?
Well, in 1915, we were actually the fourth largest city in the world. And most of that had to do with migration from, great migration from people out of Europe. And they, of course, come to New York first, and then they came to Chicago. So for a period there, we had just this enormous population, and the immigrants were certainly the largest part of the workforce at the time. And then in Western Electric, in specific with our story, they were living on the west side of Chicago in Cicero and Berwyn.
At this massive, I had forgotten how big, the massive
huge
Hawthorne Works,
yeah,
that people made telephones there. That's
right.
What they were
the
doing.
The Silicon
there.
Valley of its day.
No, seriously,
yes.
You're right. You're absolutely right.
And so when it came time for an annual picnic, these people were encouraged, tremendously encouraged to go on.
Well, but talk about how, I mean, I said in my piece about the film that they were arm-twisted, I either said arm-twisted or strong-armed into it.
Yeah.
Their managers would come around and say, well, I think, how many kids do you have, Benjamin? And Benjamin would say, I have four. You better buy six tickets for this trip.
Yeah.
What was the importance? It was a public relations effort on the part of Western Electric, right, Chuck?
The company was going to use this as an opportunity to bring film cameramen to the picnic to shoot pictures of happy people playing at a wonderful picnic and enjoying a lovely summer day together. And Western Electric had big plans for this. It wanted to show this nationwide in every theater in America. And they had organized and brought cameras to the dock and were ready to go to the picnic. And they were in place, and then the world toppled sideways. And these people were tossed in the water, and the film cameramen were there, and they did what film cameramen do. They took pictures of it, yeah. And it made horrific images that were so horrific, they were banned from public display in the city of Chicago by the mayor.
Yeah, who was also acting in a public relations manner, Big Bill Thompson, a crony of Al Capone, if not also John Dillinger. The nature of, and there are in your film, Eastland Chicago's Deadliest Day, 8 p.m. this coming Thursday on Channel 11, some horrific images. There's no question about it. Some that I had never seen before, and I'm assuming, and certainly some that were not in your first documentary. When you two, Harvey Mashman and Chuck Coppola, when you started digging further, when you had the ability and the wherewithal to start digging further, what were some of the stunning revelations you came upon?
Well, as far as the footage goes, of course, in 2015, on the 100th anniversary, a U of I grad student, Jeff Nichols, stumbled upon this cache of film in the Netherlands, of all places.
I know, and you bring that up in the film, too. That
yeah,
it was...
and then subsequent to that, we found two more repositories in England, one at British Film Institute and one at British Pathé. Now, the important thing to realize is there were three newsreel companies in 1915, Mutual, Universal, and Tribune Selig. And they were all on site. They were all following the story. They shot the funerals. They shot the morgue. They even followed the trial to Grand Rapids. But most of that has never been found.
I know.
So there's tons of hours, I don't know how much more, that's out there that was shot. And it's a fluke, I think, that the Netherlands had the wherewithal and the idea to transfer this off of this terribly volatile stock, nitrate stock,
sure,
into a safety stock so it would be available today.
What did you two think when you first saw that stuff?
Well, I was stunned that it was found.
That it was there,
believe
at all.
Me,
yeah.
We were looking for it in 2001.
We'll use this no matter what it is. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. But to me, honestly, the photos that Jun Fujita took... are to me more compelling than the footage.
See, one of the aspects of this film, again, Thursday, 8 o'clock on Channel 11, WTTW, or Channel 11, or whatever it is on your television gizmo. One of the brilliant things you do in this, you tell very articulately and powerfully, and frankly, entertainingly, the story of this poor, sad ship that went down about 7 o'clock in the morning on a rainy morning and trapped these 844 souls, including 22 entire families. Think right. about that, ladies and gentlemen. Is you so wisely find heroes in that? There are a lot of villains in this movie. Even my great idol Clarence Darrow is sort of, and we'll explain why I think so. I'm like, what? No, Clarence, no. You find especially three real heroes in this. Who are they?
Well, I'll take.
You mentioned one.
The first one. The human frog is probably our favorite.
He is everybody's favorite.
This young motorcycle mechanic had a shop up at Irving and Pulaski. And he heard about the disaster, jumped on his motorcycle. Supposedly, he had a wrench in his hand, and he came all the way downtown. The cops wouldn't let him help anybody. He cold-cocked the cop with the wrench, dove in the water, and pulled 40 bodies out of the hull. And he was dubbed the human frog by the newspapers.
Yeah.
He's a colorful character. Another one who we had sort of been searching for her photograph for a long, long time, Helen Reppa. Helen Reppa was a nurse employed
by Western Electric.
She was on her way down to the dock when she had heard of the commotion. She jumped on the back of an ambulance, rode it down to the dockside, fought her way through the crowd, through the police line, and began administering first aid and doing what nurses do. They try to save people in emergency situations. She was covered from head to foot in blood and soot and grime and grit and ashes that had been shoveled onto the side of the hull of the Eastland to prevent people from slipping as they tried to make their way off. All of that. And she's trying to save lives. And she's trying to get the police to apply a lung motor, which is a very crude device that would physically pump air into the chest of a victim who, you know, was in the throes of drowning.
There's a lung motor. You see it in the in the film, Eastland Chicago's Deadliest Day. And it looks like if I were dying, I would not want that thing. I would say, wait a minute.
We don't know how many people that actually helped
or killed.
It looked monstrous.
Yeah, it's horrifying. Yeah. Just horrifying. Yeah, she is a fascinating, fascinating character. Yeah. One of the other interesting things, gentlemen, Harvey Mashman and Chuck Coppola, is that there were seven daily newspapers in this town at the time, most of them within a few blocks of the disaster itself. Yet, this disaster, and you point this out in the film, this incredible tragedy, it got a lot of coverage at the time, but has sort of faded under history's dust for so long. And I've written about it, probably because I've been obsessed with it as long as you guys have. There's like, oh yeah, here's a little plaque. And that goes, I think, to the whole immigrant experience, does it not?
Right. There was nobody famous on board.
It was 2 years after the Titanic went down.
Right. And World War I was certainly crowding the headlines in the papers. And all these immigrant families had still relatives in Europe, and that was of more concern. Mm. And it was just so horrible, you didn't want to talk about it.
Also, in Chicago, don't forget, in 1919, there was that awful race riot.
Of course.
That wiped
which
a lot of...
we're covering like crazy today. Yeah,
exactly.
The papers, yeah.
There's a terrific story in the Tribune.
Oh, yeah, no kidding.
And that wiped a lot of other news off of the front page. And then World War I, U.S. involvement was beginning to ramp up. And so you can see that by then, this awful event that happened in 1915 kind of got pushed aside.
Yeah.
And on top of it, the immigrant population is one of the people we interview told us they didn't talk about unpleasant things, awful things that had happened to them outside the immediate family.
Damn,
so these family stories that we reveal to the public tonight or on Thursday night, these are family stories that families have kept inside within themselves for generations.
Yeah. Yeah. But they have passed them down. And that's another great aspect of your film. They have passed them down generationally. And I've heard from, since the story appeared today, from people saying, I didn't know anybody who died on that boat, but my uncle's father died on that boat, and I can't wait. And basically, I can't wait to see the movie, is what they were saying. The other guy who you had mentioned just a second ago, Harvey, was Yen Fujita, who I discovered a couple of years ago when his nephew published let some photos out. This guy, not arguably the first Japanese American photographer in Chicago, but arguably the first Japanese American newspaper photographer in the country, had you known about him before?
Well, we had seen his credit on the photos, but we really didn't know much more about him. And then,
well, we're gonna stop. We're gonna take a break, and we're gonna learn. You are too much more about him after this commercial break and the news. I'm talking to the two producers and writers. I want to talk for 2 seconds about what the collaborative process is like for you two guys, two producers, two writers, because it's a brilliant film. Want to take this time and go find your Tribune and read about it. Eastland, Chicago's Deadliest Day, 8 p.m. Thursday on Channel 11. We'll be right back. Well, that's an honor. Mr. Rick Hogan, thank you, Roger. The TV event, to my mind, not only of the summer, but of the year so far. And God knows there's a lot of good stuff on TV. But if you do not watch Eastland, Chicago's Deadliest Day, Thursday at 8 o'clock on Channel 11. And there are all these other times they run it. I mean, the television is totally confusing to me. It is the work of a lot of people, but primarily the work of producers Harvey Mashman and Chuck Coppola, who have been on this story for 2 decades now and have... There's no more to tell. I think you two, and this is a compliment, I think you have done it definitively. Do you?
Oh, no.
Really?
Well, you know, the skill in making a documentary is knowing what to leave out. And the regret is having to do that.
To leave, so you have to leave something.
So, you know, seven daily newspapers, all of these stories, there were tons of just terribly amusing sidebars that we couldn't include. There's a lot more to tell.
And there are more sidebars about June Fujita, who you just mentioned a few minutes ago.
You want to play, you have a clip from the show. Sure. Dan Long, why don't you play that clip of June Fujita, who's one of the most fascinating people in the history of Chicago.
The Eastland rolled over within blocks of seven Chicago daily newspapers, including the Chicago Herald, that published 14 editions, some just 1 hour apart with new developments. Radio would not come to Chicago for another 6 years. That morning, the editor of the Chicago Evening Post couldn't find his only photographer, 26-year-old June Fujita, who'd been at the paper for less than a year.
Calling him at his house, wasn't answering, frantic. Turns out June was already there and immediately started capturing pictures. June Fujita was the first Japanese photojournalist in Chicago. He had the big, heavy camera. Clearly, he identified with the victims of the Eastland. I think as immigrants, they shared a common story of coming over looking for something in America. A reporter asked him if he knew anyone who drowned in the disaster. And June replied, "No, I didn't know anyone who drowned, but I do all of them."
That's very moving. Very moving.
He had an empathy for the victims that he was photographing. He felt, if you will, their pain. And I think that that drew him to really continue climbing all over the Eastland. And years later, at the end of his career, when he'd covered all sorts of things, like the St. Valentine's Day Massacre.
The race riots.
The race riots in 1919. The only thing he kept an album of, a keepsake, if you will, of that day, of his news career, was an album of photographs of the Eastland.
Mm.
And he wrote also, you know, notes of what he thought about this. And he thought of what avail is, you know, pity in the face of human carelessness. He had his own thoughts about why this happened.
It was, on the level of human carelessness, something out of almost like The Great Gatsby, about the carelessness of the rich. The fact that the two owners of the boat, who had no business, to my mind, or to your mind, as you did, even owning a boat, you know, the boat becomes, to my mind, kind of even a tragic figure, not to anthropomorphize, but becomes a kind of tragic figure in this whole thing.
I would say certainly that anybody who thinks of themselves as a maritime person always wants to find the hero in the ship. And in our documentary, the Eastland does redeem herself. She is reincarnated. I won't give it away just yet.
Right.
But, you know, you want to see the ship maintained well. You want to see it in trim and in ship shape. And these two owners in particular ran her into the ground.
Yeah. It was called at one point the Greyhound of the Great Lakes because it was a speedy boat. Then it was called, and this is a haunting one to me, the Blue Collar Titanic, because the Titanic had gone down 2 years before. And this was a blue-collar crowd of 844 people, including many, many, many children and many, many, many women who died. They were mostly factory workers.
Right. I mean, you asked earlier what drew us to this story initially.
Yeah.
And I believe that in 2001, when we were first planning on doing this, there was just so few people who knew anything about this in the first place. And I'll have to tell you my Channel 11 story. So my boss walks in and says, every producer has to pick a topic for Chicago Stories, our new series. And I waited a day and I said, okay, I want to do the Eastland disaster. And the reply was, what's that?
What's that?
So I knew this was going to be a great story. And at that time...
And you also knew it, like everything at Channel 11, without naming names, it's going to be a hard sell.
Andy White from Looking Glass Theater, who ultimately went on to make a play
about
the Eastland, his inciting incident was that 9 out of 10 people he talked to had never heard of it, and I believe he took a poll standing down at the river and Clark Street asking people if they knew what happened here. And,
do you know what this plaque is about?
Yeah.
Do you know what this plaque
is? And that plaque took 50-something years to get there.
Sure.
And if it wasn't for the kids at the Illinois Math and Science Academy in Aurora, as a school project, that plaque would never have been there. And the city, to this day, still a mystery to me, why this isn't recognized. Fort Dearborn Massacre is, of course, in the fire.
Yeah.
It's not a glamorous story on the face of it. A steamship, not particularly large, not particularly great like the Titanic, rolls over in a muddy river.
Yeah.
And the people who are killed are first-generation immigrants or factory workers.
Many of whom do not know how to speak English.
It's not John Jacob Astor.
Yep. You know, it's not. And the ship has not gone anywhere. I think that's an element of it, too.
Right.
If it had been out in the middle of the lake, I think for some reason, I'm not an expert in tragedies, it becomes a bigger tragedy. Or if they had been coming back from the picnic in Michigan City and it had gone down, who knows?
It clearly looked like someone did something wrong.
Yeah.
And someone should have paid.
Well, it did. And someone, you know, the memory of the survivors, I said they were probably haunted by what happened that day because they were blamed. I mean, the tradition or the narrative was, well, these people, it was raining and too many crowded in, and then they moved to one side and they tipped the boat over. That, as you will learn in Eastland, Chicago's deadliest day, is not the case. Those people were not to blame. They were the victims. And the people who were to blame, having, you know, orchestrated to get the trial moved and moved and moved again, and then hire Clarence Darrow to defend you, that's what bothers me about that whole...
Well, the rumor was that the passengers all went to one side.
Right.
And that's what caused the tip. Yeah. It was started by the company, the owners of the boat.
Of course.
Because they wanted to lay the blame on the passengers. That turned out not to be true. And there were accounts in the newspaper 2 days later that they were packed on too closely to budge. They couldn't have actually moved all to one side.
Well, the weight of the cement, the blocks, and the
right.
and the so-called boats, the lifeboats up on top, did them in. You guys, my admiration for both of you, I know you a lot better, Harvey, for more years, but Chuck, I know your work too, and my admiration for both of you was extraordinarily high before this. And when Harvey said, well, we got a new movie, I go, oh, good, let's see. And I cannot tell you, how do you two, what is the, not to bore people in the last few minutes of the show, what is the collaborative process? I mean, in writing and producing, you guys obviously know one another very well and respect one another very well and are onto a topic that you both have your heart and soul into. What's the collaborative process?
Well, Chuck did the heavy lifting on the script. He would write the first drafts, and then I would chime in. And if it wasn't for Google Docs, because Chuck lives in California, I live here, that would have been a much more difficult process. And then since I was here, I did the bulk of the producing and getting things done. And, we also went to Canada
right,
to shoot on the Key One.
There are some recreations in here. I think that's a bold – I mean, that's always, to me, in any documentary, a bold move. I mean, it is one that has to be done with a lot of care to not look.
We were very careful not to overstep the recreations.
Yeah.
So we knew though that we didn't have any pictures of anyone boarding the vessel. Nobody bothered to take
any
a picture.
Or any real, you know, interiors of the boat,
right.
Except for the most horrific images. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So that was the first thing. And I just wanted to finish up on the process here.
Sure.
Writing. I write overnight, and so I start at midnight and I go till 4 a.m. And sometimes you get these epiphanies at 3:30 in the morning when you've been reading fact after fact after fact. And then you get this crystallization of, you know, of funerals and the collective sense of loss. And it just came to me, Chicago felt empty. I wasn't here in 1915, but after reading everything and culling through all this research, it sure felt to me as though the city must have felt desolate.
Well, 700 funerals on one day and a casket shortage will give you that. Will give you that sense. Fellas, I don't know what to tell you. I said it a lot of it in print today in the Tribune. You can read the story.
There's a couple of surprising things I can throw at you really quickly.
Sure.
One of them, petty crime. Nobody anticipated, neither one of us anticipated, the level of petty crime that was associated with the pickpockets.
Oh, when all the dead bodies. Well, and also
the newspapers called them ghouls.
Yeah.
And
well, they were
infiltrated not only dockside but the armory and the homes where the wakes were held, private homes, brazenly approaching the victims' bodies, taking valuables from the house.
Well, the other disgusting thing, too, just human curiosity, are the building owners that would charge 5 cents or 10 cents, and the people who would pay the 5 cents and 10 cents to go up to the roof to watch, you know, the human frog and other people trying to save bodies. It cannot, you know, I know you have...
Well, that's an entrepreneurial spirit. I applaud that. I mean, but, you know, somebody who can make a dime off a tragedy, yeah, go for it. This
go
is Chicago.
For it. You guys, that is the... You're getting a sense of these two grand talents, and that's the film. It is, even though it concerns one of the great tragedies in the history of this country, wildly entertaining. Congratulations, fellas. There's no telling where this... I know awards are nice, and if they come with checks, they're even nicer, but it's a great movie. The Eastland, Chicago's Deadliest Day, premieres, a real kind of world premiere, except for a couple private showings. World premiere, 8 p.m. Thursday on Channel 11, wherever you find that. Chuck, Harvey, congratulations.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
We'll be back in a couple minutes.
All right.
The music of Steve Goodman from a new release, Affordable Art. He's been gone a long time. Now, for the third time on this show, because they have a third book out, it is my great pleasure to welcome in Bob Carr and Dirk Johnson. Dirk and I were colleagues in the crazy newspaper business, and he has proved himself then at the Sun-Times and at the New York Times to be one of the most talented reporters and especially writers. That's often a weird combination. You don't often get them together, only occasionally. He and Bob have... How did you two meet? Hi, Bob. Good to see you. Hi, Dirk. Good to see you.
Thanks for those kind words.
Remind me. Oh, no, you're my constant. If you publish a book, and they're always interesting, you're booked on the show. Remind me how the two of you met, will you, Dirk?
It was through a mutual friend who was doing some work for Bob, Michael McMillan, and we had a cup of coffee at the airport and talked about life in general and some of our past mishaps and hit it off, and it's been a great collaboration.
Bob, you have had one of the most, Dirk, I'm sure you'll admit this too, one of the most interesting lives. seriously, from your, you know, sort of not impoverished youth, but a youth, and this goes to the point of your latest book too, where you needed a helping hand. Yes?
Yes.
What was wrong in your youth?
Just having a parent in the house that was very destructive to his six children. And a mother who was at the opposite end of that spectrum. It was very confusing to grow up in a house with two bedrooms and nine people living in the house. It was with a father who was just not there for you. And when he was, you wish he wasn't.
Yeah. How did you wind up being saved? You were smart. Let's start with that. You were a smart kid.
Well, I don't know how to answer that question. I always knew there was something wrong. And when I got out of the house at the age of 17, you know, things all came together fairly quickly about what happened. And I was just able to figure it out better than my siblings, frankly.
But you needed help. And that was sort of the nature of the first book on which you collaborated.
My seventh grade teacher, I think this is really the point I should have made.
Yeah, you too.
My seventh grade teacher had been a double-A professional baseball player. I was a great White Sox fan back in the late 50s. And he became a school teacher and was my seventh grade homeroom teacher and social studies teacher. And he talked about there being another world out there.
Yeah.
And he set the pace, and that's what we're all about, is mentoring these young people. And that's where I learned that from. And I'm not sure where Dirk learned his from, but I'm sure he did from someone.
Well, but in first hearing this story, Dirk, and putting it down on paper in your first book, Through the Fires, there's a $250 loan, if my memory serves.
A scholarship. Bob was a senior in high school.
Yeah.
And much to his surprise, he was awarded a $250 scholarship by the local women's club. As a kid, Bob didn't even know there was a women's club in town. And he said that it made him feel so good and recognized that he vowed that if I ever have extra money, I'm going to reach out to help kids that have come from circumstances like mine. And it took some decades, and Bob hit it very big.
I never understood. You know, I certainly admire success on any level, but I never understood what Bob did. You know what I mean? It's a you know, financial kind of, what is it? What was it?
Payment processing.
Part of it was being in the right place at the right time. I suspect you may remember the old credit card slips, back the paper slips, when you would buy something with your credit card
at a store.
Far too
well, Bob. Far too well.
Exactly. Well, I was right there at the right time when that paper transaction was converting to an electronic transaction. And so my company became the fifth largest payment processor in America, which is just hard to believe.
Well, it's an amazing... Well, it's one of those businesses that you think, wait a minute, why do you need this business? But you became incredibly successful. The great point of it is, and what Dirk must have really appealed to you, is that altruistic nature, that whole notion that someone did something for you. This women's club basically gave you $250, and you said, that's unbelievable. It empowered you in a lot of ways, and you said to yourself, if I ever make it, I'm going to give back. I would hazard to say, Dirk, and we're cynical newsmen, that for every 10,000 people who said that at some point,
right,
none except this guy followed
right,
through.
Right, right.
Is that,
and all those years later.
Yeah.
One of the things that is most striking when you're around Bob is that he really has very little care about material things. I don't think you much care. Bob doesn't much care what kind of car he drives. The idea of having a private jet strikes him as ridiculous. But when he's in a room with kids that have come through difficult circumstances, they really, really connect. He is not just another rich guy.
Or another do-gooder.
That's right.
I do have to say, there are other business people, men and women, who are generous with their funds and so on. I don't think it's 1 out of 10,000, but it might be.
I think it's one out of ten thousand. And I think, you know, okay, the Bill and Melinda Gates, I'm sure they do a lot of good things with their money, but you're my 1 out of 10,000. What, when you decided, were you doing things all along, Bob, during your career, or did it happen after? And I think there's a very important thing to sit down with someone like Dirk and share your life and have it on paper. That's empowering, too. Was that the motivating force for starting all the other things you've started?
You know, I was one of these guys who worked for 25 years and then was an overnight success.
Yeah, right, sure.
And so, sure. You know, I had to make a decision one day of what to do with a lot more money than I ever could imagine ever needing. And it was I tried doing a couple of things. I built Lockport, Illinois, is where I'm from, and we built a park in downtown Lockport, and that was a several-million-dollar project. It changed the town. I loved doing that. I'm very interested in history. I was able to buy Woodrow Wilson's house and been involved in other historical things. I was in the city council in Lockport for a while. But having all this money just really was an overnight thing, and I hadn't thought a heck of a lot about it,
yeah.
Except that I did want to give back to the women's club. And that's how it started, by giving them a check for $5,000 to pay them back for my $250.
Did they know who you were? Did they have a record of having given you the $250 at some point?
Well, they do now, because...
I'll bet they do now. Yeah, but I'm sure they do now. That's a nice thing to do. But when trying to figure out what to do, there are a lot of places that need financial help.
Amen.
And you started something... on your own, you didn't say, well, maybe I could give to some, you know, the, you know, youth basketball program or a youth baseball program or the White Sox Junior All-Stars program or something. How did you conceptualize what became your sort of...
Well, this is where I think my growing up situation, you know, really put it into perspective for me, because I knew how valuable it was to get an education. And by starting off giving other high school kids scholarship funds like I received back in 63, it became almost an immediate attraction to these kids, because they finally had somebody that recognized them. And we've been doing this now thousands of times throughout the country over these last 10, 15 years. And our model, our program works, and it works because I think I have a deep appreciation for what many of these kids have gone through.
Well, especially with your third book. The second, well, we got to take a commercial break. See, I'm so into you, I blew the commercial by like 3 minutes. We'll be back with Bob Carr and Dirk Johnson to talk about not only their second book, but their third book. And I will tell you an anecdote about something I saw on TV tonight that is so germane on 60 Minutes to what this book is about and what you're doing. Chicago Stories told 24/7 on 720 WGN Chicago. Smart speaker users just say play WGN Radio on TuneIn. 10:32, and here with the news, sorry, Roger Badish. Well, thank you, Mr. Roger Badish. My great old friend and colleague, Dirk Johnson, and I like to consider him a new friend, Bob Carr, have collaborated on three books so far. Through the Fires, An American Story of Turbulence, Business Triumph, and Giving Back, which is basically Bob's biography, sort of as with Dirk's help, and Dirk is a very talented writer. The second was Working Class to College, The Promise and Peril Facing Blue-Collar America, which was a very provocative book. In the midst of this, Bob started what is now a public charity called Give Something Back, which is meant to pay the college, in essence, to pay college tuition for kids who can't afford it. I will tell you tonight, mostly kids whose parents have been incarcerated or who are homeless, and the numbers for that, Dirk, I was stunned.
Yeah, or foster kids. Yeah.
Or foster kids. Tell me some of the numbers. They're really stunning and chilling at the same time.
There are 2.7 million kids in the United States that have experienced parental incarceration. On any given day, there are roughly 500,000 kids in foster care. And then there are many that are uncounted, that are in some sort of informal situation, but don't have a permanent home.
Well, we hear about some of these frighteningly and with some frequency on, you know, when there's a crisis, when one of the kids dies or something. On 60 Minutes tonight, and I just want to bring this up because it sort of goes to some of the stories that you told. This, the last book is First Chance, How Kids with Nothing Can Change Everything, and it's about, I got to be about 2 years of you, Dirk, going around and talking to children who are benefiting from...
Both Bob and I, yeah.
You went together, that's great. It must have been at some points, I'll get into specifics, but today on 60 Minutes, they had a story about a kid from Nebraska named Sean, S-H-O-N, Hapwood, who, you know, was a screw-up in school. He drank himself out of 1 year of a basketball scholarship somewhere. He then drank himself out of a couple years in the Navy. He then got hooked up with a guy who thought it would be a good idea to rob little banks because they wouldn't get caught. He got convicted and thrown in prison for, I think, 20 years. In his time in prison, he became a kind of a clerk in the library, started reading law books, literally wrote a brief, submitted to help another convict, and then went all the way to the Supreme Court. And so that wound up attracting a lot of attention. He eventually, through some really good mentors and people helping him, was able to become an attorney. He's now a professor at Georgetown University.
What a story.
It's a great story. But you found stories not dissimilar as you two went out to see, hey, How's this? Basically, it was to see how everything was going, wasn't it?
There was, as an example, a kid named Ricardo Dale was severely abused by a babysitter and ran away from home, was homeless, and when he came to the attention of Give Something Back, and he got a scholarship through the program, and he has now been elected to the board of trustees on the college as the student representative, as a senior. It was just remarkable for somebody that had been through the travails that he had.
See, what both of you gentlemen seem to have, and you put your money where your mouth is, Bob Carr, is an unrelenting faith in humanity. I don't mean to make much of it. I really mean that. I mean, you have a of the faith and the resilience of the human spirit that no matter how much someone is beaten up, and some of these kids have been beaten up beyond all reason, that with help, they can triumph. I mean, you do believe that, right, Bob?
I believe to my core that by going through these very painful upbringings, that kids who are able, who get something, just a little bit of help, they grab onto it, and their receptacles of all the information they can get. And the subtitle of our book about kids who are lost can do anything. We have example after example after example of that. And I just think the nature of going through all this pain and trouble creates a person when they realize they can break through all that, that they have a way to get through it. It empowers them to help others and to do what I've been trying to do, you know, with my career. And I really think that some of these kids, like Ricardo, is a perfect example. There we have many, many others. These kids become the leaders. I've given 3 graduation speeches where the student speaker, selected by the students in the college, were our kids.
Wow.
These kids become leaders. It's really a very exciting thing. And one of the problems we try to focus on is, let's stop setting low standards. Let's raise the bar. You kids can get A's and B's. You have to get a B average minimum to be in our program.
How does one apply to the program?
Usually it's a high school counselor that knows the kind of
situations,
and we want kids who have gone through, we want the kids who've gone through the worst of times, and they just have a little bit of spark of determination, and we give them some tools, and it turns them around very quickly. We picked 222 kids for our scholarships 3 years ago in 2016. Of those 222 kids, which are mostly homeless and children of incarcerated parents, 100% of those kids graduated high school, and 215
out of 222
are going to college in the fall, 97%. And these are all kids that could have been written off in ninth grade, and we gave them a scholarship.
Well, there are kids who were written off in ninth grade, but for you and the foundation, which is now a public charitable foundation, Give Something Back. I'm assuming it's givesomethingback.org.
It's actually Give Something Back, a New Jersey nonprofit.
Oh, okay. Well, you know.
To be technical, but we had trademark
issues. No, you should be technical about it. You should be technical. Some of the stories that you encounter have got to be, for both of you, initially heartbreaking. Because we now live in an era when prisons are warehouses. I mean, they're warehouses. And some of the kids and some of the parents, probably, you must say to yourself, wait a minute, this parent doesn't belong in jail.
So much of the time. Almost all of the problems that led to imprisonment are rooted in addiction, particularly with the mothers.
Yeah.
And the prisons have become the mental health providers. In as much as they provide
treatment.
As much as
treatment. They can, right. Yeah.
But there are many prisons that are actually former mental health hospitals. Logan Women's Prison in Lincoln, Illinois, as an example.
We got to take one quick last break, and then we'll carry on with these gentlemen all the way to the end of the show. You really do, ladies and gentlemen, need to get all three books. I mean, I would really, really recommend Through the Fires to be followed by Working Class to College to be followed by the latest book, First Chance. I mean, you need to read about your story, and then you need to read about your activism, and then you need to read, as you do in First Class, about this activism in action, what it is doing, what it is meaning. Now, get a pencil. I'm going to give you two websites. The first is giveback.ngo, right?
Yes.
Thank you, Bob. The other, where you can get these three books, because I think these books should be read as a kind of trilogy, though I know there will be another one because I need you back on this radio show, is Robert O. Carr. That's RobertOCarr.com. That's how you can get all three books. People obviously listening, Bob, want to know what they might be able to do. What can they do on their own? I mean, I think some people want to help, but don't know how.
Well, for every $20,000 that we receive, we can put one kid through college.
Is that right?
Which is a great bargain, and that's one of the motivations for us doing what we're doing. But there's five things that a person can do, I mean, at different levels. They can adopt a child, and lots of folks do that, and it's such a wonderful thing all around. Secondly, they can become a foster parent. We need more good foster parents in this country.
Good being the operative word.
Absolutely.
Here. And we need more good people at the Department of Children and Family Services, too.
We certainly do. Next, they can become a CASA. A CASA is a court-appointed special advocate. Every county in America virtually is connected to a CASA chapter. And we've been encouraging this, and we have been able to get many, many people to look into CASA. By being a CASA, it's a volunteer position, but the CASA is the representative of a child. And a child goes into court, and the parents are fighting with each other, and nobody's looking out for the child. And the CASA, that's their job, and it's such a tremendous program.
Oh, so rewarding.
And there are hundreds of thousands of kids going through this issues with the court, and they don't have an advocate. So that's a desperate need for that all across the country. If you don't have time to be a CASA, be a mentor. Get involved with there's many mentoring organizations around the country. We have them in seven states ourselves. And the other thing is the children that we work with, we pick ninth graders primarily, but if these kids can get some help in middle school or even more elementary school, reach out and work with other nonprofits and help get these kids the mentoring that they need. So those are the things that people can do to help a lot.
Dirk Johnson, working with this man must have changed your life in a number of ways.
In a lot of ways, yes. It's I have, as anybody who knows me has heard, I have the deepest admiration for Bob and for what he's chosen to do with his time and his wealth, and it's not, I think, what almost any other person would do to continue to work that hard at it.
And when you see, you know, being on the front lines, especially with the latest book, First Chance, all of these books again published by University of Illinois Press, going out and interviewing these young people who are benefiting from this, it's got to be terribly emotional for you, because you're getting, and you got out of them in this really good, very sort of introspective stories. That's a hard thing to do with young people sometimes.
Well, absolutely. First of all, they're young. They're living in chaos, so that to make an appointment with somebody for a week from Tuesday for kids that don't know what their life is going to look like that afternoon is very, very difficult. And then they open up. I give credit to the kids who were willing to speak on the record with their names.
And trust, there's a level of trust that they have to develop. You two are, as I can attest, both very likable guys. But, you know, I haven't told you my inner secrets yet. But right. You do. What you get from these kids, there's a real level of honesty to these stories they tell.
You know, and their parents as well.
That's true. Exactly. Yeah.
Who have... one of the main figures in the book, Mercedes Marquez, mother Angie, has struggled all her life with heroin. And she sat there with a plastic crucifix around her neck and said, "People say I'd never stick a needle in my arm. People say I'd never steal. People say I'd never stand on a corner and sell myself. All my nevers came true." This is not a bad person.
Yeah.
And that was the case so often. That these were families that were just struggling terribly.
Well, you know, what comes through in many of these stories, and you can address this too, Bob, is that human beings are incredibly fragile.
They are very fragile, but they also can be very resilient.
No question.
And what we try to do is give them the tools to help them to become resilient. Motivation is much more important to the success of a student in school than their innate ability. We all know PhDs who are, you know, working for Uber. Not that that's a bad job,
right?
But it's certainly overeducated. So by giving the kid, the student, the tools that they need to deal with it, I think, and giving them the hope of a college education. When we started the program, we gave money just like everybody else did.
Well, because that seems always, if you got it, the easiest thing to do.
And it is the easiest thing, and it was great. The kids are great. Some of them are some of my best friends to this day. But then we realized, you know what? These kids are seniors in high school. It's too late. Let's go down into 8th grade, 7th grade, 6th grade, and pick kids then. That program worked really well. So we went from giving money to giving mentoring. Then we went to giving hope. And that's why we're telling these kids in junior high and ninth grade, you're going to go to college if you get a B average. And we only had 7 kids out of 222 that didn't get a B average. And this is out of a high school, one of the poorest high schools in the state of New Jersey.
You know, there's that old, you know, what you two are doing is, and to borrow a phrase from Ernest Hemingway, you're making people, you're helping them become strong at the broken places. That's a phrase of Hemingway's. And a lot of these people are broken through really no fault of their own, the fragility of human nature. But what you're doing is you're making them strong at those places.
And these kids become leaders for the other kids in the program, and they gain strength from one another. It's palpable to be with these kids in a group.
What's your next book, fellas? When can I book you? 2 years from now? Bob, I just have to say congratulations. You're getting married a week from Saturday to this beautiful woman sitting in the studio.
Guy.
You're a lucky guy in a lot of ways.
That's for sure.
I think, Dirk, you are too, to have hooked up in this. I mean, I keep telling you to go to Robert O. Carr, the website, to buy this trilogy, which I'm calling the Carr-Johnson trilogy, because your life is fascinating. Your ideas about college education, which you could, if you could, would transform. You'd transform completely, and it's very, very topical given how, you know, college screws, frankly, kids from who don't have the means to go. And it's a rigged system.
It's very unfortunate. Yeah. There's 45 million kids in this country, not kids, people, who have started college and dropped out.
Yeah.
And now they've got to pay off, most of them, student loans with minimum wage.
It's horrible. And you've seen in, you know, recent headlines wrong. The way people try to game that system. And then you can finish your reading this summer, your summer reading, with First Chance, which is just a book about small, all because of you guys, but small triumphs over tragedies, near tragedies, and messed up lives.
Yes, it's remarkable to see what these young people have achieved.
Well, and you do it. I mean, you develop both of your level of trust with these kids and their parents to tell these stories with power. With power. It's an ongoing, I've known you for a really long time, but it's an ongoing pleasure to know you, your new bride, and to keep reading you. I hope there's a fourth. We can have a quartet.
You bet, Rick. Thank
all
you,
right, you guys.
Thank
keep
you
up
so
great
much,
work. Oh, no, my pleasure. Dirk Johnson and Bob Carr. Go to robertocarr.com to buy the books. Thank you very much for listening. Dan Long, you're the world's greatest engineer. Ro Coleman, you're the world's greatest producer. Did you say yes, thank you? Or what did you say? Nah, no, I'm not. Coming up is Carl Amari and his fabulous show.